God for this box. Otherwise, I couldn't see any of you. I was once on a panel in Toledo, and the podium was so high that all I could see was the chandeliers. And thanks to the fellow who made the box and brought it tonight. God bless you, Steve. Oh, good. Okay. Can you all hear me?
Yeah.
Because I don't like to go to a meeting and not be able to hear the lead. That's what I came for. I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Julie Mate. Hi, everybody.
Hi, Julie.
I had my last drink March the 22nd of 1962 at 10:30 at night in Rosary Hall in Cleveland. And it wasn't a treatment center. They only detoxed you at that time, and thank God for that. And all I've ever had is AA, because they told me AA has everything you will ever need, and they are right about that, and I still repeat it. Will you join me in the serenity prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Amen. I never know what's going to come out. I haven't led a meeting for some time, and by gosh, I'm not usually nervous, but I have been nervous, and it'll go away in no time at all. I know that. I want to read you something. It's a real old thing that the old timers used to read. This is a formula for drinking. If you cannot absolutely refrain from drinking, then start a saloon in your own home. Be the only customer, and you will not have to buy a license. Give your wife $12 to buy a gallon of whiskey. I know these prices are outdated, okay? There are 128 shots in a gallon of whiskey. Buy all your drinks at 40 cents a snort, and in 4 days, when the gallon is gone, your wife will have $39.20 to put in the bank and $12 to buy another gallon. If you live 10 years and buy all your booze from your wife and then die with snakes in your boots, she will have $35,750.40 on deposit, enough to bury you decently. Bring up the children, buy a house and a lot, marry a decent man, and forget she ever knew you. I like that. That's right. Suffering wife of the alcoholic. I was a suffering wife, a suffering daughter of an alcoholic, and a suffering alcoholic, and I know what bottom is. I know what the inside of hell is. I would rather die than go back there again. If you live long enough and drink, you can get where I was. If you live long enough. Most people commit suicide because they can't take it. I don't know how I lived through it. It's still to me. And how I've lived all these years. Because when I got out of Rosary Hall 30 years ago, I thought, if I live two more years, I'll be lucky. I was in bad, bad shape. And people, I'd ask, how long have you been sober? 2 years, 10 years? And I think, oh my God, I won't even live 10 years, you know, two more years. And it just, time just rolls on, and I don't know what it's all about, and I don't question it. I just accept it, and I love it, and I love this program. I have great respect for Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you don't mean business, well, stick around a while, and you'll hear some leads. You don't hear many real hard, tough ones like I used to. I loved them. Those were exciting. They were exciting stories because my drinking was dull and dreary compared to these guys. My God, roll over a cliff down 20 feet and get out of the car, not hurt, and all kinds of exciting stuff. And mostly mine was home drinking because I like to drink alone. I didn't like anybody bothering me. I didn't like jukeboxes and I didn't, I was an intellectual drunk. I sat there and talked to myself and drank. Those people up in the bars, you know, they blabbed and they repeated themselves over and over. And then they'd always want to get mean and fight and everything. And I didn't like that. I didn't want to fight. I didn't want to get hurt. I protected myself so that I could keep drinking. And I could never understand why people wanted to fight when they were drinking. And my husband and I drank together, and God, we had lots of good times, wonderful times, happy times drinking together. Send the kids to the show and drink and love, you know. Pardon me. But I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, and I had a lot of good years of drinking, real good years, you know what I mean? Alcohol did so much for me for so long that when I began to go downhill, I didn't know what was causing it. I didn't know it was alcoholism that was causing it. Oh hell, I knew for at least 10 years before I called for help that I was an alcoholic, but hey, I was handling everything just fine at that time, and I didn't know that alcoholism was fear, terror, impending doom, loneliness, despair, desolation, futility. I didn't know that these things were alcoholism. I had to come to AA to find that out because I was filled with all the darkness. I lived in darkness for the last 2 years of my drinking. And I still thought that alcohol was doing something for me. It was doing something to me. But I drank for over 30 years. The last 15 years, I drank every day. I didn't stop once. For one thing, it didn't make any sense to me to stop. I was handling my booze all right. And then when I did think about it, I found out that I couldn't quit. I wasn't about to tell anybody that. No way. Well, now let's see. Where do we begin? Thank you, Marshall. About taking this program seriously. Don't fool around with it. It isn't a matter of staying sober or getting drunk. It's a matter of life and death, I assure you. And if that alcohol gets hold of you the way it did of me, there's no way out. I reached a point where I could not even ask for help. And it's only by the grace of God that I'm here. By the grace of God, through a spiritual experience. There's something that I like a whole lot that I read. It's by Carl Sandburg. You know, there are people who think they can add to AA and make it better. Like Paul Martin from Riverside, Illinois wrote, it's like trying to gild the lily. It's like trying to make the best better. There's nothing better than this program, I assure you. I believe it's the greatest thing that has happened in this century. Look at all the other offshoots, the other 12-step programs that have started. I don't know how well they work, and I don't go to them. It's none of my business. Mine is alcoholism, and I belong right here in AA, but about there are people who think they can improve on this program. You can't do it. It was written perfectly in the first place, and this by Carl Sandburg. Whenever a society or a civilization perishes, there is always one condition present. They forgot where they came from. Nope. Just accept AA the way it is. Don't read between the lines. You know, just it says exactly what it means. And try to keep it simple, please. My God, I was so screwed up when I came here. They told me later on that for the first 3 or 4 months, they thought I belonged in Massillon, in the state hospital. In fact, I think there were a lot of people who probably avoided me because they thought, well, she's just nuts. You know, nobody can help her. But they didn't know what I had in me. They didn't know what was in here. The determination that, by God, I was going to stay sober if it cost me my life. And it gave me life. Thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous, the most wonderful thing in the world. I like that simple little thing. You know what I said about keeping it simple? Dr. Bob said, keep it simple. Don't boss it up with Freudian complexes and things that are of more interest to the scientific nature. I like this. Clean house, trust God, help others. That boils it right down to the simplest words you can. 6 words. Well, anyway, I was the oldest of 3 girls, a scared little kid. My father was a drunk. He was the meanest drunk in the world. As far back as I can remember, my dad drank. He was hauled off to jail at times. He was hauled off to jail for knocking my mother down when she was pregnant. And I hated my father. Now, I'm sorry to say this. I always thought my mother was pretty saintly. But after I was sober a few years, I remembered how she promoted this hatred in us 3 girls. You know, to hate my dad. And I hated him all my life until I came to AA. And then I had to learn to tolerate him. And that was hard. And I prayed that I would learn to love him. After he was sober, I mean, he was dead a few years, and I was sober 20 years. Some things take a long time to acquire. And I was sitting in a chair late one night, and I thought about my father. And I said, Pop, I love you, and I miss you, and I began to cry. My father, whom I hated. But you see, I worked at trying to love him. If you want to learn to love, start looking for the good in people. Try to overlook what you don't like. Look for what's good in them. And that's what I had been doing. I had been thinking about any little good things that he had done for us, you know. And thank God I got rid of a big load there. This program works, I'll tell you, if you work at it. I was a real scared little kid, and I was never happy, and I was determined that when I grow up, I'm going to be happy. Above all else, I want happiness more than anything else. Of course, when I drank, you know, that's where the happiness was, in the bottle. Booze made me happy. I drank bourbon and beer for the last 20 years of my drinking. About the first 10 years of it, I drank anything they handed me, you know. I still don't like ginger ale because they used to, when Prohibition was repealed and they'd make highballs, ginger ale and whiskey, and my God, the next day all I could taste was that awful ginger ale, and I never drink it. My other two sisters seemed to be a lot more well-adjusted than I, and they were happy and they played. Me, I loved books. I read everything I could get my hands on. When I ran out of everything else, I read the classified ads in the paper. I'm glad I did read a lot. I learned a lot from reading. I have a lot of knowledge up here because of that. And because of it, I was also a good student in school. And I liked going to school. Any place was better than our house, where my father might pick up a chair and throw it at the wall, cursing. It was frightening to me. The first drink I can remember was when I was pretty small. I know I was under 10. Mom gave me about half a water glass of my dad's homemade elderberry wine. You can call it dynamite, for a cold. And I didn't drink it right away. I let it set and I'd look at it. And I'd keep looking at that glass. Finally, I picked it up and sipped it. Oh God, it was horrible and I hated it. She said, you don't have to drink it all if you don't want to. I did not intend to either. But I sat there and I sipped until that wine was all gone. I believe that I was born an alcoholic. I don't know how we become alcoholics, but they're coming to believe that it's carried in the genes. Neither one of my sisters was an alcoholic. Anyway, I loved what that drink did to me. For the first time in my life, I was relaxed. I was happy. I felt wonderful. All the pieces were glued together. I wasn't fragmented anymore, you know, scattered. I was a whole person for the first time, and I remember I went up to bed and I fell on my head and I laughed about it. It didn't even hurt. I must have been drunk. I'm glad I didn't associate with that wonderful feeling with the barrel in the basement. I wouldn't have lived to see AA. Thank God that AA was born in my time. Thank God for that. I began to drink about the age of 15, sneaking my dad's wine. And my sister, who was a year younger, Margie, she could make friends. I couldn't. I couldn't make friends. I was always set apart. I was always lonely. I felt like I didn't belong. For one thing, I didn't like the way the world was. It wasn't perfect, you know. And God made a mess of it, in my opinion. Here was my rebellion right from the beginning, you know, that God didn't do things right. I thought of that when I was 4 years old. You know, I looked around, I didn't like the world. I felt that I belonged in some much better place. Well, I expect to get there one of these days. But my sister Margie could make lots of friends, and we were going to high school, and some of her girlfriends would say, why don't you bring some of your dad's wine to the basketball game? So I put some in a bottle and put it in a brown paper bag, and we'd go to the game, and we'd go back in the hallway and drink it. And these girls would only drink a little bit. Now that always baffled me. I think, what the hell's the matter with these kids, you know? Don't they know that it makes you feel grown up and witty and pretty and sophisticated and charming, and it makes you feel like you belong. Obviously, none of them were alcoholics. I was the alcoholic, and I ended up finishing the wine. And I had a good tolerance for alcohol. Boy, oh boy. In later years, I used to wonder, what am I doing with all of it? I don't even feel it. But I met a guy when I was 16. And I liked him very much. I dated him for over 4 years before we got married. We used to go out and drink with another couple, a big tall guy named Chuck, who, as it turned out, was an alcoholic. He was the man I called later on when I needed help. And Chuck liked drinking with me because I could hold my booze. I didn't get maudlin, I didn't pass out. As long as the party's going on, I'm right in there. And I'd go out in the kitchen and drink with the men. I liked standing on my feet and drinking. You always know what shape you're in, you know? If you're sitting down, you might not be able to get out of that chair. Or if you try to get out of it, you might fall on your face. Mm-hmm. And the men loved drinking with me, too. I was always surrounded by them. And I loved parties. Now, I didn't care too much for bars because there were lots of drunks there, and they could get mean, and especially the drunken women. My God, they wanted to fight, and I didn't want to fight. I want to have a good time. I want to laugh. So the three fellows that I went with that I liked the best, two Jacks and Lewis, all three were alcoholics. There was a special feeling for all three of these. The one Jack came into AA in the early days. He was just out of high school. He was a full-blown alcoholic. God! And he got real bad real fast. And he came into AA, sobered up, and then he was the old Jack again. Then he went out again, and he was... I can see the progressiveness right there. He was much worse. He was in terrible shape then. He was like an old man. Got sobered up again. Later on, he moved out to Phoenix and drank rubbing alcohol and died. The other Jack, well, I used to see him stumbling along South Main Street down there near Firestone where I was working. My husband and I both got sober, never had another drink after we came into this program, and you don't have to either. You don't have to. Yeah, you have to wade through a whole lot of tough times and misery and unhappiness, but it does get better. It gets better. You know, they tell me that, and I think, you know, a pile of money would help. But at the end of my drinking, let me tell you this. I remember sitting there on the couch, and if somebody had put $1 million in front of me and said, here, you can have this, I would have said, take it away, I don't want it. See, I knew that I was in such bad shape that only God could help me. Anyway, my mother had divorced my dad because of his drinking, and we got married in the Depression, and I knew my father couldn't take care of himself, and I felt sorry for him, because he had been sober through this divorce thing, and I had never seen him like that, and he was pitiful. So we moved in with him, and I thought in time we would get a home of our own. It never happened that way. We ended up living there, and I still live in the same house. My husband died. It'll be 8 years next month. He died with 21 and a half years of continuous sobriety. It's funny. We were both so different. We worked the program so differently, and I thought, oh, hell, he'll never make it. He can't do it, you know, with that slow and easy does it. Hey, that was right for him. My way of going like a buzzsaw was just right for me. Get in up to your neck and swim like the devil. Well, anyhow, I'm still ahead of myself. I keep going off into the future. But in these first years of marriage, I was real happy. I had happiness. I had love. I had peace of mind. And I didn't care much about drinking then. I think of a bottle of Applejack brandy that my husband bought, a pint bottle, because I worked real hard. Here's the perfectionist, by God, scrubbing the floor so you can eat off of them. Wouldn't leave the house if there was a cigarette button in the ashtray. I had to make sure, or a coffee cup, I had to wash that. Anything, you know, just absolute perfection. And I worked real hard. And he said, well, maybe you could have a drink once in a while. You know, I really didn't care about that bottle in that cupboard there. I had what I wanted. I had happiness. Okay, and then I had a little girl, and then I had another little girl. During the second pregnancy, I didn't even have a drink. Not that I had to try to stay away from it. I was still an alcoholic. But it just, for some reason, I don't know why, the grace of God maybe, and I didn't think about drinking. But after she was born, there was a big wedding coming up, a big hunky wedding, and the booze was going to flow freely. And I thought, I'm out of practice. I'm going to go to that wedding, and I'm going to have one shot of whiskey every hour, and I'll feel good, but I won't get drunk, because I didn't like hangovers, and I didn't like. I like getting right up about here. I didn't like getting real drunk and sloppy and sick. So I went to the wedding. I had a shot of whiskey. And I timed it, and I had a shot of whiskey an hour later. I don't know if I made it through the second hour. And I moved on up to the bar, and the bartender was an ex-boyfriend of mine. He just shoved them across, and I drank them as fast as he shoved them. And oh my God, the hangover I had the next day was the worst of my life. I have never forgotten that particular hangover. I shook all day. I retched all day. Run up to the bathroom and throw up. And in those days, I used to put on my best dress on Sunday and cook a big meal and put a big roast in the oven. Oh my God, and taking care of two little ones. Boy, that was horrible. Ugh. But you see, I was just out of practice, that's all. So the girls were beginning to grow up, and they didn't need me so much. And it's like about the age of 29 when I looked around me. And I thought, is that all there is? You know, there's got to be more to life than this. What is it? And I began the search. You know where I began the search? In the bottle, of course. I love Peggy Lee's song, Is That All There Is? When I first heard that, I knew that was written by an alcoholic. It's absolutely perfect, and I can understand it perfectly. That, you know, there's got to be something more to life. What is it? And I was searching for for what I found here. I was always an idealist, and little by little, I just let my ideals down. I let myself down, bit by bit by bit. My husband had got a good job. He was a buyer at Firestone. Oh, that son of a gun. He wouldn't come home from work. They'd go out to the golf course. We're doing business. And I thought, like hell you are. I know what you're doing. And they always had bottles. Every guy had a bottle in his bag. He made sure that there was always a bottle in the cupboard at home. Because if not, you know, I'd be screaming and really raising hell. And so the girls growing up and going out, and my dad working till, I don't know, he worked till about maybe 11 or something. I was there alone. I'm indispensable. I have to be here. They need me. And I'd sit down to the kitchen table, reach down in the cupboard, pull the bottle out, sit there and talk to myself and drink. Not only that, it's a wonderful way to drink. I didn't have to comb my hair. I didn't have to put makeup on. I didn't have to dress up. Nothing. Just sit there and drink. And a few years ago, my girls cleaned out their old bedroom. And what did they come up with? My drinking uniform. My old Bermuda shorts that I wore summer and winter. I thought they were long gone. I won't part with those. You can bury me with them even, you know. But I was so happy to see those. I wore them constantly. And it got to the point where I was so full of booze that I never felt cold. Summer and winter, I wore those Bermuda shorts and rubber thongs. And in weather like this, at midnight or 1 in the morning, you'd find me out there in those rubber thongs. And no coat, I didn't need a coat, sweeping the snow away. Oh, God, when I think, it all seemed perfectly normal then. And I thought I was being sophisticated, too. God, how I wanted to be sophisticated. Well, sophisticated is really complicated. And they told me this is a simple program for complicated people. Untangle the strings, you know. But so I was drinking every day. Lewis saw to it that I had a bottle all the time. And I loved drinking alone. I didn't have to wait for a barmaid to pour me a drink. I poured my own drinks, and I poured them as big as I wanted to, too. Now, I developed an awful problem because when I'd get up, I'd start drinking. I would drink carefully so that Lewis didn't know that I was drinking. But you know how it is, it takes more and more to do what it used to do. And we always had a fifth in the cupboard, and that fifth would go down that much. And I think, oh, he's going to raise hell when he comes home. I'd better hurry down and get another bottle, you know. He didn't even know I was drinking through the day. Hurry down, get another bottle of whiskey, refill the one in the cupboard, and then I had my own stash on the side. And I never ironed all my clothes at one time. We used to have to iron clothes, you know. And I always kept a clothes basket in the dining room. Now, I had misplaced too many bottles, so this was the perfect place. Stick the bottle underneath the clothes. Nobody's going to do your ironing for you, and I always knew where it was. On the other hand, I was getting too many empties, and my conscience began to bother me, and I thought, if I throw these out in the trash, Louis was going to say, "How come there's so many bottles out here?" So I hid them down in the basement behind the canning jars in the fruit cellar. But now what am I going to do with them? So when I'd get four or five of them, I'd put three heavy paper bags together, one inside the other, put a bunch of bottles in it, roll it up tight, take it over to the workbench, and pound it until it was all crushed up real small, and roll that up. Now I've got a small package. What am I going to do with this? You know, I'm getting crazy by now. If I throw this out in the trash, somebody's going to open it up and say, "What's all the broken glass?" So what am I going to do with that? I don't drive, you see, so I couldn't drive my bottles away. I found the perfect solution. At night when they were watching TV, I couldn't do this in the daytime, the neighbors would see. When they were watching TV, I'd go down in the basement, sneak out the side door with this package and dump it in the storm sewer right next to the driveway. There, I got rid of it. There's one problem there. That stuff doesn't dissolve and go away. It doesn't wash away. The storm sewer gets blocked up, and we're at the low spot in the street, and the street would get flooded, and I'd always have to call the city and say, "Come out and open up the sewer." You know, I got rid of that problem when I got sober. On the other hand, I was sober some years, and I heard the dog barking about 3 in the morning one night. And I looked out, and there's the guy from the corner. He's got his own sewer up there, but his mother had beat the hell out of him with a broom one time, so he's using my sewer and dumping his empties in my sewer. I told him about it, but it didn't do any good. There's more and more to that story. The man from the sewer department even knows my voice. Problems. And I thought I was so brilliant. You know, I'm figuring all this stuff. My God, if I could think that way today sober, I could make millions. But I can't seem to apply it to anything else. Because alcohol was the most important thing in my life. You think of it, the importance of alcohol to the alcoholic. And even after I was sober, walked into my mother-in-law's kitchen, and across the room, there was a bottle of blackberry brandy. You know how big that bottle looked? This big. I've never had the desire for or the thought of taking a drink since I got out of Rosary Hall. Thank God for that, because the compulsion was so powerful that I used to think, what are they going to do about this? God just lifted it completely, but I know where my help comes from. I know that I have to work this program in order to keep my mind that way. And when I was sober 10 years, talking to some man from Alliance up at the Paradise Club, and I said, "George, I wonder why it is that some people get the desire to drink and I have never had it." And God bless him, I don't know if he's still alive, but he said, "Remember, God doesn't give you anything you can't handle." And he said, "You probably couldn't handle the desire for a drink." And I said, "You know, I think you're right, George, because it wouldn't be just a desire or a thought. It would be overwhelming, driving compulsion. And I like what I've got, and I'm hanging on to it, you better believe." Pardon me. Well, anyhow, so as time went on, these fears came along, and all these dark things, and the despair, and it just got terrible. And I used to wonder, what's the matter with me? I remember, too, I don't know, this is some years before I came to AA, standing in the kitchen and thinking, when was it that I could have quit drinking? I do not dare to stop for one day now, not one day. If I try, I will lose my mind or I will die. I was living on alcohol, and that's how I ended up. Less and less food, nightmares increased, the sleeplessness increased, and I never liked medicine. Whenever I had gone to the doctor and he'd give me any pills of any kind, I'd come home and take one or two and shove them in the back of the dresser drawer and pick up the bottle. So I wasn't into any kind of pills. I was afraid of mixing chemicals with my alcohol. I wouldn't have lived to see AA, I'll tell you right now, if I'd been taking pills of any kind. And I remember after I was sober, cleaning out the medicine chest, and there was a medicine bottle about so big, half full of an amber-colored liquid. Nothing on it, no label. And I thought, what is this? I opened it up, smelled it. Oh my God, it smelled good. I poured it down the toilet, and I came to realize what it smelled like. It smelled like Manhattans. And then I remembered what it was. Old Doc Teeley had given me some nerve medicine. I drank half of it and let the rest of it set for the simple reason that it was medicine. I'm not one who runs to doctors either. Well, anyhow, it got worse and worse. I got so bad that at the end, I no longer ate any food. I don't think I ate any food for the last 2 months. I couldn't chew and swallow solid food. I no longer slept. My mind was a squirrel cage. It ran constantly. God, that was terrible. I couldn't stop my mind on anything. I was so weak I had to hold on to the walls and the front. I'm going to explode. And I think I knew what that was from. It's because I became a silent person and didn't talk to people like we do in AA. I was holding everything inside and I was ready to explode. I was in terrible shape. If my husband had been sober, he probably would have put me into a mental institution, but he was bad enough himself. On March the 18th, I lay in bed, rolling, tossing, sweating, sick, my God, but I was sick. I always talked to God in my mind. I didn't know that was praying. So I guess I was always praying and talking to God. And finally, the little voice kept coming to me and telling me, you have no more than 2 weeks to live unless. I knew the unless meant AA, and it would come and tell me that again. I knew of AA. I had read of it in Liberty Magazine in 1939, and I had a high opinion of AA. Thank God for that. I thought it was wonderful for those poor devils hanging around the corner, you know, because they had such misery in their eyes. I was young then. But thank God that I had that good opinion of AA. I knew unless meant AA. So it would keep coming back and telling me that. Time was dragging. Time was so slow. It was so horrible. Every day was longer, every night was longer. And finally I said, 2 weeks is too long. It will be like 2,000 years. And I was asking God, what do you want me to do? I had told Chuck, and I had told the sister at St. Thomas Hospital, I'm not ready yet. I will know when the right time is. Because Chuck had come to see us. The sister had called me. And this day, the voice rang in the room and it said, now is the right time. With that, I was given courage. I was given determination. Just hope that maybe I could live. Maybe. I knew I was going to die. I knew it. But two weeks was too long. So that day, Lewis said he called Chuck for me. I couldn't dial the telephone. And Chuck took me to his house the next day. There were no beds for women here in Akron at that time. That really burned me up, you know. Everything for the men, nothing for the women. After all, why can't a woman be an alcoholic? In fact, I heard the Sister Ignatia thought that women shouldn't be alcoholics. Well, it's too damn bad, you know. I didn't ask to be one. I didn't plan to be one. I just naturally was one. It took Chuck, he took me home on Monday. He and his wife took care of me. He bought a bottle of whiskey. And he'd feed me drinks. I didn't want to drink. I wanted to quit just like that, you know. But it would have killed me. I didn't, you know, I didn't know anything about tapering off. I didn't know anything. I didn't know about drying out places. And he stayed home from work, I remember, so that he could keep an eye on me because he thought I was going to die. And he was on the telephone a whole lot. He was trying to find me a sponsor. There weren't too many women in AA, and he had a hard time finding me a sponsor. You know, don't turn calls down. When you're given a call, it's God sending somebody to you because you need the help. I have found that out in these years. How many times I've begun to sponsor somebody because something's going to happen in my life. And I am the one who is going to need the help. And besides, how many of those calls ever turn out to be anything? Most of them turn out. Weren't too many women in AA, and he had a hard time finding me a sponsor. You know, don't turn calls down. When you're given a call, it's God sending somebody to you because you need the help. I have found that out in these years. How many times I've begun to sponsor somebody because something's going to happen in my life and I am the one who is going to need the help. And besides, how many of those calls ever turn out to be anything? Most of them turn out to be nothing. Chuck and Ethel took me up to Rosary Hall then, and I spent 6 days there. My husband had lost his job long before that. We had no money. We had no hospitalization. So I should have had a lot longer in the hospital, but couldn't afford it. And I used to go into the chapel an awful lot. It was right in, there was only 3 beds for women there. 3 beds. I'd go into the chapel a whole lot and talk to God and I'd pray and everything and I'd think God wasn't hearing me. Here I am on my way to recovering. thinking God doesn't even hear me. You know, I was real dumb. I'm a dumb alcoholic. I learn slowly, I find. But I enjoyed being there because I felt so safe. I was willing to do whatever I was told to do. And that's how I stayed sober. The willingness to do what I'm told to do. Because they told me, don't question it, just do it. Because I wanted answers, explain this, explain that. This complicated mind of mine. Well, anyhow, when I got out of the hospital, they didn't take me home because my dad and my husband were drinking like crazy. They took me over to stay with my married daughter. Now, I am a night person. I was born a night person, and I'm not going to strain myself to become a day person. I used to have to get up when I had the kids at home, and I did. I raised a couple of good daughters, I'll tell you right now. Thank God for that. So far, they're not alcoholics that I know of. But Louise and Joey went to bed at 10 o'clock at night. And I had my own little room, and I was supposed to go to bed at 10 at night. And my God, I couldn't sleep. I'd lie in bed and roll and toss and sweat, have nightmares wide awake. It was terrible. But in the second week, I pulled out this little book that Sister Ignatia gave me. It was just a little paperback thing, and it didn't look important. I opened it up, and on the first page, the second paragraph, it said, if God has ever shown me any love, he must love me still. It convinced me. It convinced me that God loved me too, and I began to read that little book with interest, you know, and I'd stop and think and put it into my own words. I'd read a little bit every night, and instead of sweating and rolling in bed, I got down on my knees, and I began talking to God. Oh, Ethel insisted that we go to a meeting the first night, the second night, the third night, you know, we're gone. We went to St. Vincent the first night, and it was in a storeroom that was painted green, and that was a real jump, you know. And I thought, I'm never coming back here. You know what? I joined that group, and I've been with it all these years. I joined it because I liked the people in it, because it was the friendliest group. Anyhow, on my knees, talking, able to sleep. Ethel gave me the 12 steps to read, and I thought, that's a hodgepodge. That makes no sense at all. And besides, I don't believe those people use that either. Nobody can. But I'm stubborn. My mother always said so. You're stubborn, just like your father. Okay. Stubbornness. Just continued to read those 12 steps over and over and over and over, trying to make some sense of them. You know what? My subconscious mind was picking them up, and I began working them without knowing I was doing it. And I heard the Four Absolutes discussed at St. Thomas, and I thought, now that's better. That's four simple, disconnected words, and I began to work on them. Honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love. And I used to get down on my knees every night and pray for absolute honesty. I wanted absolute honesty because I was convinced that this was the base of my sobriety. But I didn't know what I was doing. The little book said, ask God to teach you to pray. I thought, I know how to pray, but I will do what it says. And I did. I asked God to teach me to pray, and he led me in a perfect way. And I believe I spent all night on my knees for weeks because I couldn't sleep. But as time went on, I was beginning to relax and relax, and I'd find myself asleep with my head on the bed. and I began to sleep like I've never slept before in my life. Believe me, it's worth suffering for. But it wasn't until I was sober 4 years that I realized what I had been doing in those weeks. I had been working the 4th, the 5th, 6th, 7th. eighth, eleventh step. I was making my conscious contact with God, and it got so good and so comfortable that it was as if I could feel Him out here, and I'd say, "Come closer, God," and ask Him to come closer. "Let me put my head in Your lap," and believe me, it was a wonderful thing, because at the end of 4 months, I had a wonderful spiritual experience. I never knew anything like this could happen to anybody on earth. I didn't know anything about these things. And I know of God's love. The room was filled with a solid substance, God's love, so solid. And the thought was given to me that I have everything I could ever want right at this time that I could ever want. That's when I was already at home. But this was such a wonderful time. And I took my inventory. I asked God to help me with it. I never wrote an inventory. Nobody ever told me to, and I didn't have a big book. I couldn't afford one. But night after night, God would lead me back through everything that I could remember that had ever bothered me, even into my childhood, examine it and find out what was wrong with me. Other people would enter into it, and I'd say, Get out of this. This is mine. I'd chase other people out of it. This is mine. The load got lighter and lighter. And after a time, I was walking 5 feet off the ground. I was 10 feet tall. My God, that's a wonderful feeling. I'll tell you this, AA is the greatest thing in the world if you really go after it and work it as best you can. And Ethel stressed meetings. This one day at a time, you know, just living today is one of the most wonderful things there is. Because me, I always lived in the past and in the future. I was never happy with where I was, doing what I was, with whom I was. It always had to be something different. I've learned that when I'm happy, to make the most of it, to really enjoy it, to suck it dry, because I won't be happy all the time. There are things that come along that, you know, life is life. Anyhow, Ethel gave me a big book for a Christmas present when I was sober 9 months. I read through that thing and I thought, this has got to be the greatest book ever written next to the Bible. And it is. And I didn't jump into the middle of it. I began at the beginning. I read the doctor's opinion. I was in complete agreement with that book, and I read all the stories in it too. At the meetings, they used to have the upper room at practically all the meetings, and these old guys were always shoving the upper room at me, and I'd take it home and I'd read it. I'd read the message for the day, and then I began to read what it directed you to read in the Bible. I'll tell you, I learned so much. I had never been able to understand the Bible before, but for some reason now it was as if my mind and my eyes and my heart were opened up. And sometimes when I'd be reading it, the words would stand out in bold black print like something in the movies, you know, and it was meant just for me. I remember one day sitting out in the backyard in summertime on the cot, having read the upper room in the Bible, and I felt so wonderful. Oh God, I had the greatest honeymoon in the world in AA, and I could hear faintly, I could hear angels singing. God, that was beautiful. That's only one time I'd love to hear them again, but you better believe, like nothing on this earth. But Ethel told me, meetings, meetings, meetings. And she said, she didn't drive, I don't drive. She said, collect phone numbers and call people for rides. So I began to do that. Well, like I say, there weren't too many women and there weren't any who lived around me. So I was calling mostly men for rides. Well, I'll tell you this. After I got well and began to get dressed up and cleaned up, I was no dog. But when I got in a car, I let these guys know exactly what I am here for. That there's no monkey business, no funny business, and I talk AA. And I remember Joe Rudolph one time at the Crossroads meeting, when somebody had been gossiping about me, and he got up and commented, and he says, how can you get fresh with a gal that's always spouting the four absolutes? I had no trouble. I asked for respect, and I got respect. And my husband trusted me, thank God. He came in 6 months after I did. That son of a gun. He'd sit. I went like a ball of fire. Anything you asked me to do, yes, yes, yes. And boy, they got me rolling. I mean, they got me so busy. And I loved it. My God, I was useful again because I couldn't do anything but sit in a stupor before AA. And he'd go to a meeting, sit in the back row, smoke his pipe, not talk to a person, not lift a finger, and I'd think, he'll never make it. He'll never make it. He never had another drink in his life. It works. That's why I tell you the way he did it and the way I did it. That it works all kinds of ways. Now, we're individuals. And I had never been able to make friends in my life. And Ethel said, anybody you see that you think you'd like to talk to, walk up to them and stick out your hand and say, my name is Julie Mate. And I had seen people, you know, that I wanted to talk to. So I tried this, and you know what? She said they won't turn their back on you, and they didn't. And I began to make friends. Oh my God, it was wonderful, and it was so easy. And I was having the time of my life making friends with everybody in AA. And there were so few meetings at that time that the same people were at the same meetings all over, every place you went. And it was real warm and wonderful, and we became close friends. Not only that, but we didn't pick up right after the Lord's Prayer and walk out of the room. No. We got a cup of coffee and a donut. We sat down and we talked. And Jim Crawford reminded me a few years ago of how at St. Vincent, we used to sit there and talk till 11 and 11:30 at night. After all, I don't even like the word classroom. That makes it too cut and dried, too cold. This is a fellowship. There's a wonderful definition in my dictionary, and I haven't written it down, of what a fellowship is. And this is a fellowship. It's everybody used to love everybody and help each other so much. And like I say, the people were so wonderful. I don't want to lose this. don't just come to meetings and be a bunch of people sitting next to each other and then walk out the door strangers. Make friends with the people. Call people up. I remember, I don't know how many months ago it was, there were four guys that I hadn't seen for a while. And so this one evening I thought, I want to do something for AA. I got on the phone. I hadn't seen John Davis over there. I called him up. As it happened, he had been real sick. Okay. I called up Brian, left a message. He never called me back. I called up another guy, Jim. He was so happy that I had called him. The guy brought me a box of candy last week at the meeting. I guess I don't think he knows what AA is, really. He's got Bible study meetings. AA is a fellowship. We love each other. And who else did I call up? Somebody else. Oh, yeah. And I left a message and he called me back. But you know, after I made those calls, I felt wonderful. I felt just great. I tried to do something for somebody else. There's so much, and I, oh Lord, how do you squeeze 30 years of drinking and 30 years of sobriety, 60 years, into this little period of time? I got so much I'd like to say.
But I can't get another tape.
Huh?
Let me go out and get another tape.
Oh, shut up, Gene. Now, I'll tell you, AA has taught me real well. I've worked hard at this program. I really have. I've tried to be a dedicated AA, and we need more dedicated people if AA is to survive. 1970, in September, one morning, I was sweating profusely. I woke up. I went back to sleep. I woke up. I felt like somebody was chopping my arms off with a hatchet. I went, my God, what's the matter with my arms? I went back to sleep again. I woke up and I was nauseated. I went in the bathroom and I vomited. And as soon as I did, something was tearing my chest apart. But AA taught me well. It taught me how to let go and let God. And that was the time when I really needed it. I was having a heart attack, a massive coronary, and I didn't know it. I didn't know what this was. All I knew was that I had become completely helpless, and I'm upstairs, and the phone is downstairs. And I clung to the bathtub, and I said, well, God, you have brought me to this place and this time. Thy perfect will be done in me. And I meant it. Whatever. And I was given this, cast out all fear, and I had no fear at all. All the fear was gone. I was given, leave off caring. You know I don't talk like that. Those words were given to me. Don't care about what's happening to you. And something else, what was it? No matter what happens, everything's going to be all right. And that meant whether I lived or died or whatever's been in between. And I said, if you want me to get help, you'll help me to get down these steps without falling. I made it down the steps. I rapped on the window, and the lady next door was out there squirting her hose on some flowers that I had planted in her yard a couple weeks before. How do you like that? And she came running over when she saw my face, and I collapsed on the couch. She called my husband at work. He worked at the arsenal then. And I lay there, and she called the ambulance. I remember it was as if I was being carried in a state of suspension up here. I was being carried. And I was living only from second to second to second to second. I didn't know what was keeping me alive, because that pain was so bad that you can't live through that kind of pain. You can't. I remember in my mind's eye seeing my husband and my daughters like at a distance, and I turned my back on them. I turned my back on my whole life and went into the unknown. When the ambulance got to the hospital and I heard the doors swish open, I opened my eyes and there were a bunch of people waiting there, and they pounced on me. I learned later it was heart team number one. And I'm answering questions, and then the lights went out. I was told later on that I had died in emergency, and they brought me back. Yeah, this program works. Believe me, I wouldn't, if it wasn't for AA, I probably would have panicked at that time and killed myself with panic. And instead, 4 days in intensive coronary care, and then they took me up to my room. My God, you should have seen the visitors. You should have seen the cards, the gifts, the plants, the goodies. Hey, I was queen for a day. I loved it. I didn't know that many people cared about me. And a nursing supervisor said she was told to come up to see my room because my daughter had stuck up all the cards and on the door and everything. She said, "What are you, some kind of a celebrity?" I said, "No, I belong to AA." Thank you, and God bless you.
We're going to pass the baskets. We are self-supporting to our own contributions, so if you can help us out here, pay for the coffee and all that. Open the floor for comments.
Hi, thank you, Julia. And you've been an inspiration. I never realized in 30 years of sobriety, you had 30 years of drinking, and that was a hard time. Now you're in serenity, concentrating in AA. They go to work. I'm glad you brought that up.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank you for sharing. You said so much, it's kind of hard to make a comment. You know who to thank, you know to thank God. I thought it was pretty neat that you liked to read. I couldn't read when I